Hi, this is Glenn Rawson. One of the most powerful ways to share history and heritage is by the telling of stories. We began sharing inspiring stories nearly 30 years ago. Each of those stories is true and was intended to inspire and strengthen faith. Over the years, those stories have reached millions around the world. This podcast is for you to listen, learn, and enjoy. My friends, welcome tonight. Thank you for joining us for another Fireside. I'm really excited about the stories we get to share tonight. And again, as always, thank you for being here and for joining us for these stories. To begin with, I'm excited to share this story with you. I did considerable research on it. Stephen Elkins, Blackfoot, Idaho, where I used to live for so many years with my family, gave me this story, and I went digging and found some more documents on it. Wonderful story. Remember the theme that I gave you, witnesses of miracles and mercies. November the 7th, 1879, about 250 miles off the coast of Newfoundland in the North Atlantic. At 8:45 p.m., four missionaries of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints were just attending to their evening prayers when suddenly the ship's engines stopped. Moments later, a jarring impact shook the ship. A great crunching noise of crumbling timbers and sheet metal rang through the cold, clear night. The moment I read this story, I was taken back to the North Atlantic, into those waters just off the coast of Newfoundland. I've been there. I've been over much of the course of the Titanic. And the first thing that came to my mind was an accident that would occur just about 40 years later, the Titanic. Well, anyway, the missionaries, thinking that their ship had collided with another vessel, ran out on deck. To their horror and astonishment, they saw looming above the bow of the ship ice. Elder Henry Aldous Dixon, originally of South Africa, said it was a clear night. The iceberg looked similar to a bluish white cloud looming up about 50 feet, an awful and grand sight, he said. Not only that, tons of ice were piled on the forecastle deck of the ship, which had been traveling full steam. This is a steamer, not a sailing vessel, at 16 knots when they struck the iceberg bow on. Elder John Lee Jones inspected the damage and reported, and listen to this, if you know anything about ships, consider this. The force of the collision was so great as to cave in completely the ship's bow, that's the front, and to break off and pile up more than 20 tons of ice on top of the deck. Both anchors were severed. The huge hole in the bow, 30 feet deep into the ship, by 20 feet wide, as big as a great room, extended below the watermark, and the break extended along the whole length of the keel. How in the world can this ship stay afloat? Water immediately began to flood into the forward compartments of the ship. Sailors who had been on deck at the collision were buried under the ice, at least one of them very seriously injured. Elder Jones reported, quote, "To all appearances, we were to have a watery grave in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean," end of quote. Well, as you can imagine, there was pandemonium among the passengers. One Presbyterian minister prepared himself to meet his maker. Elder Dixon records, quote, "I called the boys together," meaning the missionaries, "I called the boys together during the excitement and prayed the Lord to enable us to avert calamity that it might be no worse." He said, "We exercised our priesthood, prayed for a calm and that we might live." They prayed also that the captain and crew might have the wisdom, the insight, and the skill to save the ship and passengers. Accordingly, the captain ordered all heavy stuff, baggage and so forth, moved to the stern of the ship. Bales of cotton were brought forward and put into the forward compartments to slow down the flow of water into the ship. And then the captain turned the ship towards St. John's, Newfoundland, and set out on a course towards St. John's at a speed of 8 to 9 knots. It seemed like a long shot and a desperate gamble. The only way that this could possibly work is if the ship had perfectly calm glass waters. Elder Dixon continued, quote, "We went below to our cabins, prayed frequently according to the order of the priesthood for a calm sea and no wind, as this is apparently our salvation temporally." At one point during the night, and the record is not clear whether it was Elder Dixon by himself or the elders who went up with him, but he said, quote, "We went on deck and while alone rebuked the winds and the waves." And then he said, "We have a calm sea. Prayers answered. Committed ourselves to God." As he moved among the passengers, Elder Dixon, moved by the Spirit of the Lord, promised the passengers, quote, "No lives should be lost or ship either, in the name of the Lord," end of quote. 36 hours later, the SS Arizona limped into St. John's Harbor. Hundreds turned out to see it. Passengers, crew, and ship, all safe. The captain and crew considered it, quote, "nothing short of a miracle." Incidentally, shortly after the accident, the owner of the ship, the owner of the Guion Lines, was informed of the accident. The first question he asked, "Are there any Mormon missionaries aboard?" When he was told, "Yes, there are 4 of them," he then informed those around him, I'm quoting now, that he knew the vessel would land safely and that they were to have no further worries or fears. He said his steamship line had carried Mormons for 30 years and had never lost a ship on which missionaries were passengers. Carrying Mormon missionaries was the best insurance he could buy, Mr. Guion said. And with that remark, he returned to his bed and went to sleep. Brothers and sisters, the Lord is with us. And when we are on the Lord's errand, he will go before our face and he will be our rearward. I've always loved that phrase from Isaiah because it means to me, borrowing the vernacular of the day, when we're doing what we should, the Lord has our back. First story. When you talk about witnesses, this man in the dispensation of the fullness of times, in the restoration, this man stands preeminent as one of the most important witnesses of our time. Oliver Cowdery. Let me tell you a little bit about him. Oliver Cowdery was born in Wells, W-E-L-L-S, Rutland County, Vermont, October the 3rd, 1806, the youngest child of William and Rebecca Fuller Cowdery. When he was only 3 years old, his mother passed away. From there, he went to live with an aunt and uncle, but they too passed away. In time, his father remarried, Keziah Pierce Austin, and 3 more children were born to the family. One of those children, Lucy, would eventually marry Phineas Young, the brother of Brigham Young. Now, as he grew up, Oliver and his brothers received an exceptionally good education. Around the year 1827, evidently, Oliver moved from Vermont to Lyons, New York, not too far from Palmyra. Then in October of 1828, Oliver's brother, Lyman Cowdery, was appointed the school teacher in the Palmyra area. But after accepting the position, another commitment forced him to withdraw. He recommended to the school board that they appoint his younger brother, Oliver, to that position. They did so, and Oliver accepted the appointment as the school teacher in the Palmyra district. Among those sitting on that school board was Hiram Smith. Because Oliver was single, he asked to board with the Smith family. Now, sometimes it's stated that it was just customary for those who sent to the school to take in the school teacher, but that may not be verifiable. It may very well be that Oliver had heard about the Smith family and wanted to come and live with them out of curiosity. Either way, he went to live with the Smith family. The records show, and they have found the records, that there were 107 students enrolled in Oliver's school, and among them were the Smith children. Well, after Oliver had moved in, of course, he heard the rumors about Joseph Smith Jr. and the Gold Bible. He was intrigued. At the same time, and we don't know by what means, he developed a friendship with David Whitmer of Fayette, New York. The two of them were exceedingly curious about what they'd heard about young Joseph Jr., and they wanted to know more. When Oliver asked the Smith family, they were very tight-lipped, kept the information close to the vest, didn't want to say much about it. Finally, at Oliver's insistence, Father Smith shared the story with him. Listen to this. Oliver would later say, quote, "It was working in my bones. I couldn't think of anything else," end of quote. Lucy Mack Smith records that as soon as he had heard about this, Oliver made up his mind that as soon as school was done, he would travel to Pennsylvania and he would scribe for Joseph. Lucy Mack says, "From this time, Oliver was so entirely absorbed in the subject of the record that it seemed impossible for him to think or converse about anything else." Oliver's convictions came from more than just a passing curiosity. Joseph would later testify that Oliver, the Lord appeared unto a young man by the name of Oliver Cowdery and showed him the plates in vision and also the truth of the work and what the Lord was about to do through me, his unworthy servant. Therefore, he was desirous to come and write for me. That is why Oliver was so obsessed, and that's why he wanted to go to Pennsylvania to write for Joseph and scribe the Book of Mormon. Well, as the spring of 1829 approached, the Smith family were forced off of their farm by deceit and fraud and forced to move into the small log cabin that they had built on the Palmyra side of the line in which they'd once lived, thinking that the accommodations for so large a family would be too tight for Oliver and he would not want to be there. Lucy suggested that he might look for lodging elsewhere, to which Oliver responded, and this is telling, "Mother," he said, "let me stay with you, and I can live in any log hut where you and Father live, but I cannot go away from you. So say no more about convenience. I care not for it. I can do well enough." Finally, March 31st, 1829, after months of anticipation, visions, revelations, and information, the school term ended, and immediately Oliver set out for Harmony, Pennsylvania, in company with Joseph's brother, Samuel, carrying $65, his year's wages for teaching school, in his pocket. They arrived in Harmony, April the 5th, 1829. 2 days later, beginning Monday morning, April 7th, 1829, Oliver began to scribe for Joseph, assisting him in the work of translating the Book of Mormon. Oliver would go on to scribe almost the entirety of the Book of Mormon. He would be there for the receipt of the Aaronic priesthood, then the Melchizedek. Oliver would be there to witness countless revelations. He would be there as one of the first original members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Oliver was there through much of its early history. Oliver was there in the Kirtland Temple when the keys of the work for salvation for the dead and the sealing of the living was restored. Oliver was the assistant president of the church and the principal witness next to Joseph. But then he became angry, prideful, as the Lord had warned him, and was disaffected. And in April of 1838, Oliver was cut off from the church. When my partner and I, Dennis Lyman, were working on the History of the Saints episodes, I learned that story and felt a strange prompting. We should do an episode about Oliver. So I began researching it. And this is what we found. In 1838, Oliver was bitter and angry, resentful of the prophet Joseph Smith, angry over the way the church had managed money in the Kirtland banking affair. He was also, in some measure, perhaps justifiably angry at the unjust behavior of certain other church officers. He was called before the High Council in Far West, and he was asked to answer the charges against him. On the basis of principle and pride, Oliver refused to appear and was excommunicated from the church. At this critical moment, other men. Now, the prophet Joseph sanctioned that excommunication, making whatever else went on irrelevant. Now, this is important. Oliver left shortly thereafter, fled Far West, and went to Richmond, along with David Whitmer. When the two of these men, both high-ranking church officials, David Whitmer, president of the church in Missouri, and Oliver Cowdery, assistant president of the whole church, when these two men arrived in Richmond, Missouri, the enemies of the church gathered around them like salivating dogs around a piece of meat. And immediately, now, said to them, "All right, now, tell us the truth. Did you really see those plates? Did you really see that angel? Come on, tell us the truth." What would you do to court favor among your newfound friends? To their surprise, Oliver affirmed that the testimony that he had written in the front of the Book of Mormon was true, and that he did indeed see the angel. He would not deny his witness, even at the peril of his own life, certainly not for the advantage of courting would-be friends. He was true. Oliver was angry. Oliver was disaffected, but he was not an apostate, not in the full sense of the word. For 10 and a half years, Oliver was outside the church. He started out in Richmond, Missouri. Eventually, he made his way back to Ohio, where he set up a law practice in Tiffin, Ohio. He maintained favorable relations with friends in the church and strove all that time diligently to maintain a reputation worthy of a man who had seen what he had seen. He tried to be a good man and a good Christian. Now, fast forward. October 27th, 1848, near Canesville, Iowa. There was a general conference of the church in that area being held outdoors. On a would-be rostrum, makeshift rostrum, Elder Orson Hyde of the Council of the 12 Apostles was speaking, conducting the meeting. As he was speaking, a carriage came up into the trees and around the back of the congregation. The carriage stopped, and a man, not very large in stature, stepped out. Elder Hyde peered at him intently, and then suddenly came down from the stand, walked straight to the back of the congregation, embraced the man, and brought him up on the stand and gave the pulpit to him. With great emotion, the dark-haired man took the pulpit and spoke to perhaps the largest audience of saints he had ever addressed. And this, according to witnesses, is what he said. Friends and brethren, my name is Cowdery, Oliver Cowdery. In the early history of this church, I stood identified with her and one in her councils. True it is that the gifts and callings of God are without repentance. Not because I was better than the rest of mankind was I called, but to fulfill the purposes of God as he called me to a high and holy calling. I wrote with my own pen the entire Book of Mormon, save a few pages, as it fell from the lips of the prophet Joseph Smith, as he translated it by the gift and power of God, by the means of the Urim and Thummim, or as it is called by that book, Holy Interpreters. I beheld with my eyes and handled with my hands the gold plates from which it was transcribed. I also saw with my eyes and handled with my hands the holy interpreters. That book is true. Sidney Rigdon did not write it. Mr. Spalding did not write it. I wrote it myself as it fell from the lips of the prophet. It contains the everlasting gospel and came forth to the children of men in fulfillment of the revelations of John. Brother Hyde has just said that it is very important that we keep and walk in the true channel in order to avoid the sandbars. This is true. And then notice this coming from Oliver. He says, the channel is here, meaning in the church. The holy priesthood is here. He continues, I was present with Joseph when the higher or Melchizedek priesthood was conferred by the holy angels from on high. This priesthood, as was then declared, is also to remain upon the earth until the last remnant of time. This holy priesthood or authority we then conferred upon many and is just as good and valid as though God had done it in person. And then he concludes, I laid my hands upon that man, and he points to Elder Hyde. Yes, I laid my right hand upon his head, and I conferred upon him this priesthood, and he holds this priesthood now. He was also called through me by the prayer of faith an apostle of the Lord Jesus Christ. End of quote. Shortly thereafter, Oliver Cowdery met with the High Council standing in Canesville, Iowa. He asked for no position, no station. I only wish, he said, to be identified with you. I am out of the church. I am not a member of the church, but I wish to become a member of it. I wish to come in at the door. I know the door. I have not come here to seek precedence. I come humbly and throw myself upon the decisions of this body, knowing as I do that the decisions are right and should be obeyed. The High Council approved. November the 12th, 1848, the witness next to Joseph of the restored gospel and its keys, Oliver Cowdery, was rebaptized. His intent, his whole heart, was to go west and join the saints. But Oliver was sick. He did not have the strength to make the journey in 1848 and 49. He was given then by President Brigham Young an assignment to go to Washington, D.C. and plead the cause of the saints. But again, illness prevented Oliver from making that journey. June of 1850, that Oliver's sickness worsened to the point where he knew he was going to die. David Whitmer records, as he attended him at those last moments, he said, Oliver said this, quote, now I lay me down for the last time. I am going to my Savior. David Whitmer said, he died the happiest of men. Oliver, the great witness, died of tuberculosis at the exact same age that tuberculosis had taken his own mother. Is Oliver's witness and testimony invalid because he stumbled for a time? No. Should he be struck off of the page with the three witnesses? No. Heavens no. Mark my words. If you get the opportunity beyond the veil to go and meet with Brother Oliver and ask him for his testimony, he will surely be just as firm there as he is now. He is still the witness of God's abundant mercies in this last dispensation.
Thank you for listening. Many of the stories you heard today have been published and are archived at glennrossinstories.com. If you would like more information, you can communicate with us there. We will be back again with another podcast next week.